So Vivian Anderson, a full-time realtor in Madison, Wisconsin, grew up in California, but is not at all what the Beach Boys had in mind. She has a Master's of Divinity degree to complement her Bachelor's in Psychology. She loves public speaking and is eager to talk about topics from real estate to church to Trans 101. She's a member of the Wisconsin's Realtor Association, where she serves on the Cultural Diversity and Housing Committee, where she's also a member of the Junior League of Madison and the Home Buyers Roundtable. Vivian can fly, she can forgive sins, and she can sell a large house in a single day. She's basically a superhero in heels. Please welcome Vivian Anderson.
Howdy. Good afternoon. I think I'm hitting like three different mics at once here. So I am a former pastor, and I have to tell you that I feel a little bit like Chum. I was thinking about coming out and doing like 5 minutes of like fire and brimstone, but I'm not 100% sure I'm not getting punked. So let me see. I will have tons of time for you for questions Basically, I'm going to do some introductory stuff, and then you can ask me about whatever you want to ask about church, because I have no idea what that might be, other than how to kill the church, which you don't really have to do because they're doing it themselves. Let me say I'm a former pastor. I feel much better now. I should also warn you a little bit of ground rule just for me. I tend to swear like a sailor. Something I learned from my mother. If that's going to stress you out, the exits are clearly marked, and maybe coming to a presentation called Jesus fucking Christ isn't the right thing to do. All right. So, yeah. So I am, at my core, a storyteller. I'm going to start out with a story, and I want to be very clear that this is not some sort of faith-promoting bullshit. This is a story to help you understand how I got suckered into church. So, back about 1995, I was dating a Mormon girl, which is always a mistake. I've dated a lot of Mormon girls. I've got a soft spot in my heart. But I was driving, I was helping my mother actually move from California to Arizona, and I had gone to Arizona State University for my undergraduate degree, and I'd gone there in an attempt to get as far away from my mother as I possibly could. So her moving to town was not exciting to me, and having to help was not very exciting either. But I was driving, so because my mother was cheap, she was doing this herself, and I ended up driving a U-Haul across the desert. I don't know how many of you have ever driven across the desert. I don't know how many of you have ever driven a U-Haul across the desert. But it is a boring experience. Once you get out of Phoenix, it's basically just like 6 hours of little bumps, little rocking back and forth. It's good times. And this was a U-Haul that was like no other U-Haul I've ever had. First thing, it ran on diesel, which you never see anymore. It had a four-speed manual transmission, which was great for me, bad for probably just about everybody else. Bench seat, this one was like from the 50s. Bench seat, steel dash, AM radio that you could get stations when you were in town. And I didn't know that you couldn't get stations when you got outside of town. So I was just driving along, out in the middle of the desert, and the radio has faded out, and I'm starting to fall asleep. It's warm. Nice white noise going on. We're rocking back and forth. Nothing to look at because it's desert. Which, don't get me wrong, the desert's beautiful for about 10 minutes and then you get bored with it. So I'm driving along and I'm falling asleep, and usually what I do when I'm falling asleep while I'm driving is I crank up the radio and I find something I either want to sing along to, or I find some crazy talk radio station that just irritates me and makes me mad and makes me scream at the radio, because then I'm awake at least. Rush Limbaugh's great for that. But the radio, which had been like, I'd been pulling in every station in the world while I was in Phoenix, now that I was out in the middle of the desert, nothing but static the whole way. And I'm turning back. And I was, at Arizona State, at the time, I was a philosophy major, which of course meant that I was a pretty hardcore atheist and pretty happy about it. Because if you're going to pass classes in philosophy, you're not going to profess that there's any sort of God. So I'm driving through the desert, and I've fallen asleep, and there's nothing on the radio. And I'd been dating this Mormon girl, so I'd been, like, reading stuff, and, you know, read the Book of Mormon, and you know, the stuff you have to do. And maybe it's just out of, like there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. Like, I would just wanted to stay alive at this point. And so I said, I very quietly prayed. I said, God, please let me turn on the radio and have there be a station. I just want to stay alive. And I reached over and I flipped on the radio, and throughout the entire dial, okay, there was one song that came in. It was the Friends theme song. I think it's the Ramones, I'll Be There For You. So I'm thinking this is kind of strange, right? About 3 miles up the road, I pull off at a rest area because I needed to get some caffeine in my blood. And I'm thinking this is kind of strange. And I get out of the truck, and I walk around the front of the truck, and I see that there is no antenna on this truck. And I'm a pretty serious atheist at this point, so I'm, you know, this is coincidence. I'm fine with this. And I go in, and I do my business, and I come back out with soda, and I'm thinking, you know, it'd be really nice. And I think I prayed again. I think I said, you know, it'd be really nice if there was a piece of metal or something I could jam in here and use as an antenna. As I'm walking around the side of the truck, there's an old metal coat hanger. Now, come on! Now, this is not faith-promoting bullshit, but I will say 5 years later, I found myself in seminary, which was a terrible mistake. I like to refer to my time in the church as the lost decade. Seminary, I'm going to tell you, is not at all like you expect it to be. Seminary is not Hogwarts, which is really disappointing. It is not at all solemn. You know, I think everybody goes to seminary and they think that, like, you know, we're all going to be praying and quiet. And, that is not the case. I have been drunker at seminary than I've ever been any place else in my life. There was a wife swapping group going on at my seminary, which wasn't my thing, and I'm saying no kink shame, but it was there. I'm saying it's seminary. It's also, seminary, quite frankly, is hell. It is a four-year, at least the seminary I went to, was a four-year academic master's program. I had to learn Hebrew. I had to learn Greek. I had an internship where I spent several months working as a chaplain. I had an internship where I spent a year in a congregation. And along with that, you would assume that people who are going into the ministry, that the church would be very supportive of that. But all along the process, they're really not even vaguely supportive. They are constantly judging and testing and making sure that that you are, I suppose, not crazy, which is really got to be hard to do. Because I think if you're at seminary, you've got to be a little bit crazy. Okay, second page of notes. I've only got 3 pages of notes, don't worry. Once I graduated seminary, I spent about a year working as an interim pastor in Belmont, Wisconsin. Fabulous folks. One of the reasons that I ended up in seminary was that I felt called. I felt called to ministry, which is a difficult thing to explain, but is there anybody here who's like a lawyer? Like a lawyer, maybe a paralegal, I don't know. Why did you go into law? Okay. So you felt like a personal calling, dare I say. I think most professionals feel that. I mean, there are people who go into, you know, medicine, probably not anymore. People who go into law because they like money, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that the vast majority of professionals go into their field because they feel that it's an appropriate place for them. They just feel like it's right, which is the way I felt about ministry, which confused the living shit out of me. But the other thing is that I really sort of bought into the church's whole, like, let's feed the hungry and shelter the homeless and clothe the naked routine, which I thought was great. And while you're in seminary, my seminary professors were like, that's fantastic. We need people who are going to go and do more of that. And I was like, rad. But when you get out into the field, when you get into the parish, you find that there's nobody in the parish. None of your parishioners really want to go out and feed the hungry. They kind of look at you and they go, "So, Pastor, if I understand this correctly, you want to give money to poor people." Which was a surprise for me and a huge disappointment. Because really what I wanted, that was basically all I wanted to do, was give money to poor people. And I found that my parishioners had no desire to do anything even vaguely involved with that. And I found this first in Belmont, Wisconsin, wonderful people, but really bad ministry opportunities. I took a call next in a little town called Elizabeth, Illinois. Anybody know where Elizabeth is? One, two, I'm impressed. It's a town of 700 people, and I didn't actually live in town. It was 7 miles outside of town. Which is like when you can't, it's a town of 700 people. Yeah. So rural. And I spent 4 years there, just about 4 years there. All through that time, it was really frustrating for me because it was batting heads with my parishioners as far as like, we need to be involved in ministry activities. We need to be doing what it is that Jesus told us we're supposed to be doing, right? And of course, none of them wanted to do it because they didn't want to give money to poor people. It got bad enough. I was there in 2008 during the start of the recession and stock market crash, and my bishop had sent out compensation packages for clergy, and I was supposed to get a raise that year, and I knew it was 2008. People were losing their jobs. Nobody had any money. And I went to my church council, and I said to them, "Look, you guys, I know like nobody's getting a raise this year. That's cool. That's not a problem. You don't have to give me a raise. Just give me an extra day off." I was working 6 days a week. I said, "Just give me an extra day off so that I know you respect me and care." Right? My church council was like, "That's awesome, Pastor. Thank you. We didn't know we were going to pay you." So the really lovely thing about being a pastor, at least in my denomination, which is the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, which is not at all evangelical, might be Lutheran, I'm not sure it's a church. It is in America. You can ask me more about that later. I'll probably tell you a little bit more about that a little bit later. So one of the wonderful things about your compensation as a pastor in the LCA is it gets voted on by the congregation. So after worship one Sunday, it's like, "Now before you all leave, we got to take care of some business." And where my church council had thought that it was wonderful that I was giving up a raise, when it went in front of my church council president stood up and called me out and talked about what a no good SOB I was, and how if I had, you know, all this extra time, or if I had extra time, that there was lots of other things I should be doing. Some of them, the things that I had been pushing my congregation to do that they'd been refusing to do. Because believe it or not, little old ladies in the church, anybody's grandma here go to church? All right, that seems reasonable. I hate your grandmas. Little ladies in the church are horrible. They will put up the biggest fight about any kind of change, any sort of new thing. I'll get back to that. So, 2009, now see, I was a little flustered when I got up here, so I didn't give you the whole introduction. Let me go back to introduction. I'm going to answer three of your questions right now. First question, I'm 6'2". Second question, yes, Chick. Third question, yes, Dick. So in 2009, I was just at the very cusp of coming out, and I had told three people in my life, my ex-wife and two of our closest friends. One of the three of them, and I still to this day can't pin it on any of them, it could have been any one of them, called my bishop and told them, hey, by the way, Pastor Anderson is trans and thought you should know. Now, in 2009, my church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, had voted on a national level that they were going to allow gay and lesbian, non-celibate, homosexual people be pastors. So it's not like it's a closed-minded church. It's a relatively open-minded church. But being trans was one step further than my bishop was going to handle. And he sent, instead of calling me up and being like, hey, so what's going on? He sent one of his assistants to my office, who showed up one day without an appointment, which is fine. Unexpected and unusual, but fine. And he sits in my office and he says, yeah, so the bishop wants you to resign. Okay. I had no idea he'd been called. Had no idea where this was coming from. Had no idea, like, what this was about. And so I asked him. And he says, yeah, I don't really know. Which is bullshit. He knew. So I thanked him, sent him on his way, kicked him out of my office, and got on the phone and called my bishop, who did not return my call. Called him the next day, did not return my call. Called him the next day, did not return my call. And as clergy, I had access to the bishop's schedule, so I knew he was going to be a couple towns over doing an installation, so I just showed up. Technically, I was invited, but I wasn't planning on going. But I just showed up, and it was in the fall. It was late fall. There was snow on the ground, and I was wearing my clergy blacks. So I was black pants, black shirt, white collar. I had my big wool coat on, big black boots because getting through snow. Basically, I looked like death. And when you walk into a church and you look like a pastor, people will get out of your way and do anything you ask them to. It's awesome. So I asked, I was like, hey, does anybody know where the bishop is? And they're like, yeah, he's downstairs. So I went downstairs, and there's this long hallway in this church. And I saw him at the end of the hallway, at the back, maybe to the end of the chairs from here. And I saw him, and he sees me. And our eyes lock. And I start walking towards him, and he's just kind of stopped. And I get to him, and so my bishop was about 5'6", maybe. He was not a big man. He was a big man, but not a big man. And he sees me, and he kind of stops, like, deer in the headlights. Like, he does not want to see me, doesn't want to talk to me. And so I walked up to him, and I was like, we're gonna get this. So I walk up to him, and I get up to, you know, conversation distance, and he steps back. I'm like, all right, well, walk forward. We'll do this little dance. And eventually I have backed him up against a wall, and he can't go any further back, so he's got to talk to me now. And I said, so, Bishop, I understand that you want me to resign. And he says, well, yeah. And by this point, I was tired of being a pastor. I was already looking for another gig anyway, so I didn't really care. I wanted to do it on my time. That's a whole different story. So I said, okay, you want to go ahead and tell me why? Because I think that's a reasonable thing. And he hangs his head, and he kind of looks down at his feet, and he says, well, I got a phone call, and I heard that you're a transvestite, which was news to me. I mean, the vocabulary was all wrong, but that's all right. And I was at that point where I was coming out, and I was like, I was not going to hide myself anymore. And so I looked at him, and I said, yeah, absolutely, that's who I am. And I said, it's not going to impact my ministry. Nobody in my congregation needs to know. At this point, like, I'm looking at, like, a new call anyway, in some place where it would be acceptable for me to be, blah, blah, blah. And he just shakes his head, and he shrugs his shoulders. And that was all I got out of him. I probably could have fought him and won on that, but it would have been a huge deal that I didn't want to get into. I already wanted to move on, and I was already looking for a different gig anyway. So after I left that gig, I spent a year coming out. I ended up working for, moved to Madison, ended up working for another congregation as a lay staff person because I was in the middle of a divorce and I desperately needed money. And working as a lay staff person in a church where you had previously been a pastor, it's sort of a punch in the face. And the money's not that great. The money's not that great being a pastor either. Mr. Joel Osteen, fuck that guy. Seriously, fuck that guy. So I took this job as a lay staff person, and ideally the idea behind this job was that I was supposed to start new ministries in the congregation. I was supposed to start with the congregation members, find out how they wanted to be engaged in their world, and help them to find a way to make it happen through the congregation. Awesome. This is why I got into, this is why I went to ministry, this is why I go. Fell down and hit my head yesterday. This is why I got into ministry in the first place. So I was like, this is a perfect opportunity for me. I will totally take this job. And I found all of your grandmothers. First thing that people told me that they wanted me to do, there was a group of relatively young parents who had teenage kids. And they were like, schools are not teaching our kids sex ed. We do not want to talk to our kids about sex. Is there any way that you could put together a sex ed program? I was like, it's unconventional. I like it. Yeah, absolutely. I can do that. And I looked around, and there's a great program through the UCC and the Unitarian Church. And I was like, we're going to totally use this. This is fantastic. And I took it to the church council. The pastors were both pretty excited about it. Took it to the church council. And your grandmothers went, no. We will not talk about sex in church. And I said, well, you know, you don't have to, but there are people who would like to. But that was a no. It was basically the same experience I'd had in Mossback or in Elizabeth and in Belmont all over again. One of the things that I wanted to do is do a kitchen incubator kind of a thing where people who are starting out food carts, people who are starting out with food businesses, they need a commercial kitchen to be able to make food. And we've got a commercial kitchen in our basement that's going unused 6.5 days a week. And I'm like, hey, let's use this, right? No, all your grandmas are like, we might have a funeral and we might have to use it. Yeah, once a month, what the fuck? So that was a no. What else did I want to do? I wanted to do a whole bunch of things at this congregation. And the congregation really, like a youth program, they begged me to put together a youth program. And so I did. And you know, a youth program at church is it's like 95% fun. I couldn't get kids to show up to go to, like, driving go-karts. Anything that was fun, they wouldn't do. They just wouldn't show up, much less actually moving on into ministry stuff. So eventually, it's the only place I've ever been fired from. I've got fired from church. I'm pretty proud about that. I think I got fired from church twice, technically. Especially the first time I resigned, technically. But it wasn't my choice. Yeah, all right. So that's sort of my background with church. Like, if you're annoyed with the church, I'm 10 times more annoyed, and I will tell you dirty stories about the church as much as you want. I asked a bunch of my friends at seminary. I said, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to a room full of atheists about church. What would you want to tell them? The number one answer I got from almost everybody was, tell them we're not all the same. It's like hashtag not all Christians. And I think they do not want to be lumped together with Joel Osteen, with the evangelical movement, with anybody that thinks that Donald Trump is a decent human being. Sorry, is there anybody who thinks that Donald Trump is a decent human being? I'm going to ask you to leave. Okay. That's what they wanted me to tell you, is that there are different churches. There's, you know, like you go into the grocery store and you want to get like the really cheap crab because you've got people coming over and you don't want to give them the good stuff. So you get the crab with a K that's really like whitefish that they flavor with crab goo. I will tell you that a lot of the evangelical churches, I will tell you pretty much every evangelical church, it's like Christian with a K. It's got all the imagery of being a church, but none of the theology. Which, if you want to talk theology, I'll talk theology with you forever. I hate most of it, but I'll talk about it with you. And that, you know, I tried to imagine what you guys wanted to hear from me, and the only thing I've got, I came up with was, like, how to kill the church. And I will be honest with you, you don't have to do anything. The church is killing itself. The church is working as hard as it possibly can to be as irrelevant as it possibly can. All right, so that's what I've got for you. It looks like I've actually taken up, like, 25 minutes. I'm impressed. Who's got questions? Whoever gets the mic first.
Okay, I would actually like, you know, now or later or sometime to hear more about what was it, the Evangelical Lutheran, whatever it's called?
The ELCA.
ELCA. The reason I'm asking is this, because they put out one of the sweetest, best, nicest national statements of why they accepted evolution that I've ever seen. I mean, it's enough to make you cry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, we want the best for our children. We want our children to be able to develop the gifts that God gave them, which may mean going into science. And we want them to be able to explore as far as they possibly can. Therefore, as a denomination, we accept evolution, basically for the benefit of our kids. It's like, that's so sweet, you know, and I think the word evangelical fooled me.
Yeah.
But it was just a very interesting experience for me as an evolutionary biologist and atheist to read this, you know, this particular statement. I thought there's hope out there. This is not bad, you know.
Okay.
But
yeah,
anyway, so your opinion, you know.
I will tell you that they mean it. Their messaging is probably overly fluffy, but they do mean it. I will tell you that the vast majority of clergy in what we would call the mainline denominations, the Lutheran churches, the Episcopal Church, the UCC, certainly the Unitarians, they're all very open to evolution. It's when you get into, like, the places where they're throwing snakes around, or telling you to hate the faggots, those are the churches where they're really going to be very anti-science. But the more mainline churches are very forward-thinking, and I would go so far to tell you that from a Christian perspective, if you're going to take on that perspective, and you're going to use that mindset, I would say, and have said in the pulpit, that that science, at its very core, is a very faithful endeavor. That if you believe that God created the earth in however God created the earth, that trying to understand God's creation at its core is a very faithful endeavor.
Yeah, and I'm just going to add that one of the things that I try to do as someone who is promoting the acceptance of evolution, I do speak in churches because there are a lot of churches that are embarrassed by creationism and intelligent design, and they will participate in things like Evolution Weekend, and it's like, anybody wants me to speak at their church, I will. I'll even run my stuff past, you know, the minister or something to make sure I don't say anything horribly, horribly offensive so long as it's scientifically accurate.
Yeah.
But what fooled me was the word evangelical in all of that. So that was where I got a little bit surprised.
So the ELCA was born out of a merger, I want to say in 1984, and at some point I was tested on this in seminary. It was made out of a merger of the ALC, the American Lutheran Church, and the ELC, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, which popped up in the 50s at some point, certainly before evangelical meant what it means today. So they were very excited. I mean, evangelical at its root really just means that we're going out and talking with people and trying to bring in new recruits, new believers, telling people about the Jesus. Seriously, I can do the 5 minutes of hellfire and brimstone. It's not my tradition, but I can do it. So don't be fooled by the ELCA or the evangelical in the ELCA. The ELCA is actually the most liberal of the Lutheran churches. We were referred to, I say we, I'm not one of them anymore. Old habits die hard. We're the ones referred to by Garrison Keillor as the happy Lutherans.
Thanks, Vivian. Question. You kind of brought us up to 2009, I believe, but how did you eventually leave your faith? I mean, how did you eventually, you know, leave at that point? So you're out of the church. So what happens
And I will tell you that when, so going from being an ordained person, like you have an obligation every Sunday to retell the same story, the Christian story, at least some part of it. And you are really obligated to talk about things through a Christological lens. And I will tell you that when you are freed from that, when you are freed from interpreting everything from 9/11 to what you want your Taco Bell order to be through a Christological lens, the world gets much larger when you can explore things from other faiths. And I will tell you that certainly interfaith stuff was part of my seminary education, but when you can start thinking about mysticism and other sorts of things, the world gets a lot larger, if that makes any sense. Sometimes people ask me what my sort of religious experience is now, and I usually tell them I'm a witch, which has two advantages. First, it makes them not ask any more questions. And secondly, it's true.
If the churches are dying out, why is it that religion gets 95% or so of school vouchers that go to religious parents, and that seems to be increasing in this state?
Yeah, I think that has to do with religious schools being most of the private schools. I think that there aren't a lot of, whenever I see a private school, it's always like St. Matt's Academy for Kids or something. I don't see very many secular private schools. And I think realistically, the people who are typically interested in vouchers, and certainly not everybody, but the people who are interested in vouchers tend to be of the more religious type, and what they're really trying to do is get public school money into private schools, into supporting churches, essentially. That's my perception.
I was curious, do you think the book that we call the Bible supports... two questions.
Yep.
Predeterminism.
Yep.
And okay. And annihilation versus hellfire.
What do you mean by annihilation versus hellfire? Okay. So certainly the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, certainly does talk about annihilation versus hellfire. It doesn't even really talk about hellfire. I mean, it's certainly a term that comes up. But the Jewish theology that comes out of the Hebrew Bible, certainly during the first century and in larger contexts even today, certainly talks about sort of annihilation, sort of talks about like there not being an afterlife, that people live on in the memory of their friends, but not necessarily certainly not a corporeal resurrection. That comes later with Jesus, which does talk about life after death. Yeah, I mean, there's a big change between Hebrew Bible and New Testament. There's a big shift, and you can't really understand the New Testament without understanding the stories of the Hebrew Bible and where that tradition came from, and the tradition that birthed the New Testament, the Jewish tradition of the people who were living in that community, in those communities, and living in that sort of theological milieu, and how that informed their writing. If you were to just look, I mean, even sitting in our social location today as North Americans, reading through the Old Testament and the New Testament, it's going to sound very different than it would have to us if we had been doing it 20 centuries ago in the Middle East. You can make the argument either way. I will tell you, I just don't like it. I don't have, like, you know, I and we used to sit in seminary. We used to go down to this bar. I went to seminary in Dubuque, and there's this bar called the Busted Lift. And we used to go down and sit in the bar after comp line on Thursdays, and we would hash these arguments out way more detailed than we ever did in class. And I will tell you that, like, there's decent arguments there. They're reasonable. I don't like it. So I go with the other arguments, and I'm straight up about that. Like, there's no necessarily good reason. From a theological perspective, predeterminism seems really stupid. And it seems... if you're going to be predeterministic, you have to believe in a God that is ultimately evil. Which you can make that argument, and I can make that argument. But I don't think it's a good argument when the foundation of your faith is that God is good. And you can talk about what that means for hours on end as well. But if your idea is that God is good, then predetermination forces you to believe that this mass swath of people, no matter what they do, are simply going to be condemned to whatever it is you believe they're going to be condemned to, which really makes it hard to say that God is good in that situation. So I suppose there is a good theological argument why I don't buy it, besides just not liking it personally. I don't know if that made any sense, but feel free to hassle me later. Seriously, I still feel like chomp.
You seem like the kind of person I can ask a question to that.
Oh, you can ask me any question.
That I've wondered about with others.
Yeah, yeah.
Having been a pastor, did you ever go back to people and tell them that you had steered them wrong or that you had screwed them over, basically, by promoting.
Back to my congregation, be like, I'm a shyster.
Yeah. Sort of like maybe even correcting something that you had ended up doing incorrectly or messing with somebody's life.
You can certainly say that any sort of evangelical sort of work, teaching confirmation, you can say that's messing with somebody's life, and I'll go with you there, that's fine. But believe it or not, I've never gone back to my congregation and been like, no, it's all a lie! I didn't do that. It would kind of be a fun experience, honestly. I think if I showed up to my congregations today, they'd be like, who the hell are you? Why do we have this tranny in our church? Get the hell out. It's a great question. I think if people, I don't have a lot of contact with my previous parishioners, mostly because I try to avoid Illinois like the plague that it is. Anybody here from Illinois? I hate your grandmothers too, by the way. So I don't really have a whole lot of contact with my parishioners, but if one of them were to say, what about blah, blah, what do you think about something? I would certainly have a more frank conversation with them now that I'm freed from interpreting everything from a Christological lens and able to talk about things in a more, much more open way. I would certainly do that with them, but it's not like I've gone back to them. I mean, I still do occasionally get invited to preach places, which confuses the shit out of me. The last place I preached, I called everybody a bitch, and they loved me. True story. So I haven't gone back and told people, like, sorry, I'm a fraud, and you're stupid. Because they're not going to hear that anyway. They're still good church-going folks, and they're going to buy them. They're going to stay there. And you have to realize that a big part of why people go to church isn't because they have a deep theological need to express themselves and to be in community with other Christians of Christ, as clergy would say, and hope. A lot of people go to church because there are great business contacts there. They go because it's their social outlet. Certainly those who were alive in the 50s, that was a big social outlet. People go to church because they want to be good people. I think the reason you see the vast majority of evangelicals in church, the theology is atrocious. They just want to be seen as good people. There's a thing called American civil religion that we talk about in seminaries, we talk about amongst clergy, and really what it comes down to is like what it means to be a good American also means being a good Christian in a lot of people's minds. You hear the arguments about, well, this is a Christian nation. The hell it is. But it all goes back into that. I mean, people don't want to be told the truth in church. They want to be told that they're great. Yes, sir.
So I'm always fascinated by the theistic transition from saying that I believe in a God, which is kind of a single big vague claim, to deciding on a particular denomination, which is a lot of very specific claims. So I'd be interested to hear how you kind of transition from, oh, God is manifesting in my radio, to right. Now I'm a member of the ELCA.
Right. So, I mean, I grew up in America. My mother drug me to church, kicking and screaming. I went to confirmation in a Lutheran church. It was what was familiar and comfortable to me. I am sure that if I had grown up in Japan, I would have followed Shinto. If I had been born in India, I would have followed one of the many beautiful faiths in India. I think it's just a question of culture at that point. It's enculturation more than anything else. Way in the back.
Hi, I don't know if you mentioned it. I had to leave the room for a few seconds. And the timing would have been a little off from when you left the church. But are you familiar with and do you work with the Clergy Project?
I am not familiar with, nor do I work with them.
The Clergy Project is an organization that helps people who are in the clergy, who have lost their faith, transition back out into the real world.
Oh, that would have been great like 5 years ago.
And, well, I think they were around 5 years ago, actually. You might be interested in getting in contact with them because your experience would be something that would help other people who are trapped in a theological hell. You know, a lot of these people, like you, they don't know what else to do with their lives because this is all they've ever done.
Yeah, and I mean, like, seminary training, depending upon where you go to seminary, is pretty rigorous. And I have a master's degree, and I can't get a job. I mean, I sell houses for a living, and it's not because I find it so ultimately fulfilling. It's because I can make some money, and I'm actually kind of good at it. By the way, if anybody needs to buy or sell houses. Did I see one more?
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, so when you were asked to resign...
Uh-huh.
Was anyone supportive of, you leaving and doing what you felt was right for yourself?
So, I will tell you, you know, they talk about men living lives of quiet desperation. Having lived that, I can tell you it's true. I will tell you that I think clergy live greater lives of quiet desperation. We get together in our clergy groups and we can be pretty honest with one another. The thing is that there's such a divide between clergy and parishioners. Clergy are pretty much afraid of their parishioners for the most part, because parishioners can be motherfuckers. I mean, just horrible people in some cases. Some of them are really beautiful people as well. But I think a lot of clergy, we feel and we talk about, we have these theological convictions, but we know that if we talk to people about them, they won't buy it. So, when I was first coming out, I did not tell were my parishioners. I was also living in a very rural, very conservative part of the state, and my parishioners, I'm sure, all voted for Trump. And I didn't feel safe at the time talking with my parishioners about that. Physically safe, living in the parsonage and right across the street from the church. So, no. And certainly none of the other clergy in the area were particularly supportive. Once I came out more publicly, a lot of my friends from seminary were really supportive. But that was after I'd already left the church. That was after I'd already moved on. So there weren't any of the sort of official denominational questions anymore about my fitness for service or anything like that.
All right, that's all we have time for. Will you be available for a little bit if people
sure.
want to come up and ask you questions in person?
Sure.
We'll be back at 4 p.m. with the next talk.